I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, there was a war of words in the Republican Party. Former presidential candidate Mitt Romney called Donald Trump a phony, a fraud, and a con artist, saying his promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University. Trump fought back, calling Romney a choke artist and made a crude remark about Romney begging for Trump's endorsement in 2012. Last night, at yet another Republican presidential debate, Donald Trump and Marco Rubio went at each other, Trump calling Rubio not much of a lightweight and a little guy. Then they went back and forth about the size of Trump's hands. Trump reassured the audience that he does not have a size problem. Yikes. Today, we look at the language of this campaign and others, also how spin and spin doctors shape political discourse. And we have two guests who are joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Christopher Cerf is co-author of Spinglish with his collaborator Henry Beard. He was a contributor to the National Lampoon. He's published several humorous books about politics. He's also a composer, lyricist, most notably for Sesame Street, and he was a producer on PBS's children's literacy series called Between the Lions. And Christopher Cerf, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And sitting next to you and also joining us is David Greenberg. He's a historian of American politics, professor of history and of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. And he's got a new book called Republic of Spin, an inside history of the American presidency. And David Greenberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You're welcome. Chris, let me begin with you. But David, I'd love to have you weigh in on this. And I don't want to spend the whole time talking about what happened yesterday, but none, there are many words that we can talk about in this hour. Chris, how did a presidential debate devolve into a fight about things like size and sex and body parts?
It's just amazing. I don't know that I can answer your question fully, but I do know one of the Spinglish tricks that might have gotten us here is that Trump is an expert at, whenever he's confronted, just insulting the person who confronted him. And so eventually, this campaign has devolved into insult after insult. Actually, Rubio is the one who started the size argument by talking about the size of Trump's hands and saying kind of slyly, you know what that means. But I'm not sure why Trump felt a need to answer that or volunteer an answer to that on national television.
David, have we been here before as a historian of presidents and politics?
Well, certainly insults and invective go all the way back. You know, there were charges in the Thomas Jefferson, John Adams presidential contest. You know, one was accused of being an infidel and a philanderer, and the other of being a hermaphrodite. It still doesn't quite rise to the level of slinging these charges and worse on national television. But, you know, the American political campaign is rooted in controversy, in you know, fisticuffs, in a lot of verbal warfare. So this does come out of a tradition, even though we seem to be striving to hit a new low.
But well, Teddy Roosevelt did talk about speaking softly and carrying a big stick. So maybe this is just part of that line of reasoning.
Do you think, David, they used bigger words back then if they used the word hermaphrodite, for instance?
Maybe they thought size matters, at least when it comes to vocabulary. There has been a change in our political discourse, no question, so that, you know, there are words that never would have appeared in the New York Times that now appear. There's words on primetime television that no one would have dared utter when television first came on. So we have seen a kind of devolution in what we're willing to say before, you know, any ears.
Chris, what examples of Spinglish did you hear last night?
Well, there were several. Some we've been hearing all through the campaign. Ted Cruz actually uses a lot of traditional spin. He talks about principled constitutionalists, for example. That apparently means anyone who is against giving psychopaths assault weapons, you know. One of the really great examples of spin on both sides is the term gun safety, which the Democrats are saying more and more because they don't want to imply that they're taking guns away. They're just making them safer. But the people on the other side talk about things like citizen disarmament. So, you know, that's actually the same thing, just two different ways of spinning it.
What I noticed last night, and David, I'll put this to you, is Donald Trump being very outspoken and out front about the fact that he is flexible. He is going to change his mind or has changed his mind on a number of key issues. Now, you know, not so long ago, that was called a flip-flop. Is sort of flexibility a new spin word, you think, that has some resonance today?
Yeah, so you know, politicians are always kind of looking for ways to couch and to soften what the media have over the previous period kind of judged to be unforgivable sins. So if flip-flopping, you know, has been the great sin of politics, political campaigns for the last many election cycles, we need to sort of repurpose that as flexibility, as open-mindedness. And by the same token, you know, a kind of crude dogmatism, you know, it comes to substitute for what we once thought of as consistency.
Chris, one of the things that has the Republicans have talked about so much on the campaign trail is this notion of political correctness. They object to political correctness, and in some cases, sort of building their campaign around this idea of rejecting that. I know that word is in your book, your Spinglish book. How should we think about how the candidates are using that?
Well, it used to mean people who were oversensitive or using oversensitive language when you use that as a criticism. But now I think it's become synonymous, or at least it's a code for anything that seems to go out of its way to be considerate to minorities or people with disabilities. Trump is able to insult all those people by saying that it's politically correct not to insult them, and he's against political correctness. It's quite remarkable.
How do you see that, David?
Well, political correctness, in some ways has come to mean liberal, too. So, you know, we hear the notion that, you know, well, you know, who needs this politically correct recycling stuff, right? So that anything that sort of seems to be coming from the left end of the spectrum can be conveniently dismissed. You know, at the same time, the college campuses, and I know whereof I speak,
sure,
teaching on one, seem to be doing their best to give the Donald Trumps and other kind of conservative arbiters of this stuff all the ammunition that they can handle, you know, for racially insensitive remarks. We have microaggressions and so on. So there's certainly some basis for this. And, you know, one thing I suggest in Republic of Spin, my book, is that when spin is really effective, which it often is not, but when it is, it usually rests on some element of truth. It may be exaggerated, distorted, but that when it resonates with us, it's because we see what the spinner is really getting at.
And I go ahead, Chris, and I want to pick up on that.
Just going to say, Henry and I did a collection of politically correct language a few years ago.
I remember
and,
that.
And David is absolutely right. I mean, one of the terms in our Spinglish book is fat-tractive, for people who say that you can't talk about people of size anymore. They're fat-tractive. I mean, it's hard not to make fun of that, and I think that's what David means when you talk about these things resonating. Obviously, that's going a little bit too far. Microaggressions is an amazing term. It means that the tiniest insult is a deep, deep sin.
Well, I want to get back to both of your books here, and I just want to pick up on one thing that passed across my mind. I'll go to you, Chris Cerf. What I've noticed on the Democratic side, and I'm talking about the two candidates running for the nomination, is that the word liberal has now become progressive. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the main reason for that is the Republicans have been so successful in making liberal a dirty word that even the Democrats don't dare use it anymore. If you're liberal is now bad. I think there's something that Steven Pinker, the linguist, called the euphemism treadmill. And, you know, the word progressive is going to become bad just the way liberal did, and they're going to have to come up with something else.
Let's go back to both of your books. And David, for our listeners, how do you then see spin?
Well, I use spin in sort of a broad sense to refer to the general phenomenon of political speech that's putting an angle on it, putting your argument on the case, putting the best face on it. So for some people, spin means deception or even lying. I think what spin really means is a little bit distinct from lying. It's sort of trying to go up to the edge while stopping short of lying, trying to make your best case. Because, you know, after all, when political speech, you know, we don't really expect it to be totally neutral. It would be very strange if a president gave a 20-minute speech from the Oval Office on why we should go to war, followed by 20 minutes on why we shouldn't, and then said, you know, you people decide, call in or go to this website and cast your vote. We expect the language of leadership to be partial in both senses of not complete, that there's a certain portion of it that's being put forward, and also partial to one side. We still want it to be honest, but it's going to kind of play around the borders. And I think, you know, the closer it comes to that border, the more it sort of sets off the alarm bells of spin.
I mean, definitionally, the closer you get to that border, the closer it becomes a lie, doesn't it, David?
Well, sure. And when you cross the boundaries, we can call it out as a lie. And there's been a lot of journalism, a lot of commentary, not just in this campaign, but for many years now, where we're pointing fingers and saying this politician's a liar, this president lied about this or that thing. And while presidents and politicians, of course, do lie, you know, a lot of the time you start to look at the charge of the lie and it seems that it is rooted in a partisan point of view, right? That there's often perspective and political values layered into the value judgments of what's true and what's false.
So, Chris, how do you define Spinglish?
Well, we're picking up because we're a little satiric about it, of course, though every single word in our book is one we found. We didn't make any of them up. But we're amused by some of what I guess David would say are the less skillful examples of it. Politicians who are covering things up or caught in a lie usually come up with some pretty amusing ways of handling that. The word lie itself, Oliver North called it cleaning up the historical record at one point, which meant he was destroying all the documents that disagreed with what he was lying about. And even last night, Ted Cruz talked about a tenuous relationship with the truth, which is his way of saying that Trump was lying, but he didn't actually come out and say it.
And in your news report at the top of the hour, we heard Marco Rubio trying a little bit to explain away the fact he said he would support Trump should he get the nomination by saying, well, you shouldn't vote for him because he's a great candidate, but because Hillary's such a terrible one. That, to me, seems like a pretty good case of spin.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's David Greenberg. He's a historian of American politics, professor of history and of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. He's got a new book called Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency, joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Also with us from that same studio, Christopher Cerf, co-author of Spinglish, and he was a contributor to the National Lampoon. He's also a composer and lyricist. He is written for Sesame Street, and both of them joining us today on Radio Times to talk about spin and Spinglish and the language, the discourse of politics. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. I'm talking with Christopher Cerf, co-author of a book called Spinglish, and David Greenberg, author of a book called Republic of Spin. Both of them joining us as we deconstruct what happened yesterday, both with Mitt Romney and also last night, and looking at political discourse, certainly what's going on now. And David can talk a bit with us about some of the history of this political discourse, including spin and spin doctors. We have an email from VZ. It's a good one. So is socialist a bad word politically? Chris, do you want to take that?
Well, I think it comes out of the entire attitude the U.S. has had about communism and all of that. It's just a code word for again, people who are treasonous, actually. So sure, it's a bad word, but it actually just means a view of an economic system. But it's tarred. It's become, you know, tarred with a lot more meaning than that.
But do you think Bernie Sanders is rebranding that word with his popularity, certainly among a lot of Democrats and liberals?
Well, it seems that way to a point, but I have a hunch if by some stretch of the imagination he gets the nomination, that that word is going to be used against him wildly.
And the spin, I might add, that Sanders uses, which, you know, goes back decades, is democratic socialist or right. social democrat. Right. So these are ways, and, you know, it's a legitimate spin to signal, you know, I'm not the Soviet Union totalitarian kind of socialist or communist. You know, my socialism fits well within American democracy.
Well, that's right. Socialism and communism are not synonyms anyway, but they've become that in America over the years.
I'm curious about to you, David. So when did we begin to see spin rooms and spin doctors and spin alleys? When did we begin to see that in politics?
Yeah, this I discuss in my book. Originally, I start my story with Theodore Roosevelt, and there was the phenomenon of spin, but it was generally called publicity or even propaganda, which not until World War I did that take on the negative connotations that we associate with it today. And then actually, because of precisely the phenomenon that Chris mentioned before, the euphemism treadmill in Steven Pinker's word, the terms for propaganda, publicity have changed throughout the years, and I have a nice review of this in the book. And in the 80s, we get to spin because it comes out of the debates, appropriately enough. After the presidential debates, there began this custom where surrogates for the candidates, and we've all seen them in action, would talk to reporters saying why their man had won, whether they believed it to be true or not. And the reporters interviewing them knew that this speech was less than sincere. And the audience watching the reporter interviewing the surrogate also knew this. So we were all in on the game. And so this was called Spin Alley. And within a short time, we got so many of these people, they had to be upgraded to the spin room.
Right.
But that's really where the term spin catches on, in that sort of post-debate commentary and spectacle.
In fact, you write, spin has an impish quality. It doesn't take itself too seriously.
Yeah, exactly. So a term like propaganda, you know, we associate with the heavy hand of government, messages being kind of forced down our throat, brainwashing even, a term from the 1950s. But with spin, you know, the audience sees what's going on. We can see through it. We can critique it, make fun of it, you know, as Chris does. And we can even applaud it when it's our guy spinning for a cause we think is good. You know, in that case, we see it as effective communication, as witty rhetoric, as, you know, a strong debate performance. So spin acknowledges that the audience are not a bunch of mindless sheep, but that, you know, we too can play this game and make our judgments and see through this rhetoric.
I mean, you think that and not all people, but you think most people, they hear whatever's going on in the spin room about who won the debate, that they know that that's spin and it's kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge?
I think so. I mean, look, people have very different starting points of where their ideological beliefs are, where their political commitments are. So what I may hear as, you know, a pack of lies from Donald Trump, you know, somebody else may say, okay, yeah, he's exaggerating or he's blustering, but his fundamental point about thus and such, the Republican establishment or what have you, is exactly spot on, right? So people can filter out what is kind of there for rhetorical effect and what is an essential truth or an essential claim that they're responding to.
Do you think it makes people more cynical, Chris?
I do. I think that what David's talking about is exactly right, but it's not the only kind of spin. There's spin that you don't notice, which is perhaps more devious. I mean, Henry and I in our book are amused by all of it, but some of it is really quite tricky. The word virtually is a great word, for
yes.
example. A few debates ago, Trump said that virtually every business deal I've done was an amazing success. Well, that may be true, but the word virtually is rather important because he had four bankruptcies that were also among those things. But virtually means that not all of them were. You hear an advertiser say that this dishwasher gets dishes virtually spotless. Well, that means they have spots on them, you know, so that's more devious.
And that reminds me of one that as writers we sometimes use. You know, until fairly recently, I was described as finishing a book on political spin.
Oh.
Finishing means, well, I've started it.
Right.
That's right. They talk about a project being in the early stages of finalization. That was something I heard said about the New York City Second Avenue subway, which I think is in about its 80th year of being built now.
Chris, I don't know if this is spin or Spinglish or what it is, but I've noticed that the Vice President, Joe Biden, uses the word literally, like literally every other sentence. I don't know if you've noticed that or not.
I hadn't, but I'm going to look for it now.
And literally, of course, is now being used to mean not literally. Literally is often being used to mean figuratively.
Now my head is entirely exploding. Actually, let me go back to your book here, Chris, and I'm looking at the definition of least untruthful, and we've been talking about, you know, lies.
Well, that's totally wonderful.
Tell that story.
Well, least untruthful comes out of something that UPS company used to rate its drivers, and they used least worst. One of the ratings you could get least best, because they didn't want to insult someone by saying they were the worst drivers. So least untruthful is right up there. Double negatives are great.
Well, and it's something that James Clapper said. This goes back a couple of years. He was before a Senate hearing talking about the National Security Agency and whether they were collecting data on millions of Americans. He said, no, I'm looking at your book here. And then he goes on NBC's Andrea Mitchell's show. And when she confronts him about what he said his answer was the, quote, least untruthful manner possible.
Right, which that's not saying anything. It's brilliant. A similar thing that those agencies have done is another example of the euphemism treadmill, is that torture became enhanced interrogation techniques. And that, of course, means torture, but it sounds a lot better. But people eventually caught on to it. So now they use the abbreviation EITs, which means absolutely nothing. So But eventually people will catch on to that and they'll have to do something else.
And I know so many roads lead to Trump. But what's interesting, Chris, about Trump is that he uses the word torture and does it, you know, with almost abandon.
Yeah, that's part of the political correctness thing we were talking about a little bit earlier. David, you might want to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, in a weird way, you know, Trump is certainly quite good at spin, at sort of media manipulation and spin in many senses of the word. But for a lot of people, they see him, and the exit polls say this, as telling it like it is, that they see him as their regard for him. And I'd say this is sort of true for some people on the Sanders side, too. Is a kind of reaction to what they perceive as so much phoniness and inauthenticity in politics. And because there's so much spin, because consultants and speechwriters and pollsters have become so involved over the last 100 years in shaping the way that politicians talk and pose and you know, conduct themselves, the politician who seems to be unfiltered, candid, shooting from the hip, seems to be authentic, and that holds a lot of appeal for many people.
You bet. What I find really amazing is that Trump has succeeded in making the media the bad guys. Of course, a lot of people have been trying to do that. But once you completely accept the fact that the media is terrible, then anything they accuse you of, he can turn back on, that's just the media saying I'm lying. And people love it, so that he actually goads them into saying it. And that seems to help him in the polls every time it happens.
But it's so interesting when you look at some of these fact-check organizations, PolitiFact and others, and they look at what Donald Trump says, and you know, many of them are lies, some of them are pants on fire. So you have this sort of weird combination of people feeling that this person is authentic, and yet when you fact-check him, much of what he says is not true.
Well, the concept of authenticity really does need to be distinguished from, you know, telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under oath in a courtroom. I mean, authenticity is a political style. It's a name we give to a political style of someone who appears to be speaking from the heart, you know, as I said, shooting from the hip. The fact of the matter is authenticity can be a stand-in for someone who is spontaneous, who is funny, who is down to earth. Could be any of those qualities. And those qualities, although they can be natural, can also be learned. So let me just give one historical case. In 1948, Harry Truman was not regarded as a particularly good speaker on the new medium of radio, relatively new medium. And he goes into the studio to practice. But this is not well known. So in 1948, at the Democratic Convention, he gives this new style of speech, which is from notes. It's described as ad-libbed, extemporaneous, and he gets rave reviews. And people did not know that he had spent many months in the studio with Leonard Reince, the Democrats' broadcast coach, working on his pacing, working on how to wean himself from the written script so he would come off as more relaxed and down to earth. Now, Harry Truman was a salt of the earth kind of guy. It's not that he was a phony, but there was practice. There was artifice in constructing the image of naturalness.
Let me get some callers in. We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I see emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Tim from Havertown to join our conversation. And Tim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a super interesting topic. I'm really curious about Donald Trump and the idea of spin. I think we may be seeing a different kind of spin with Trump that is sort of outside of the political sphere, where you have people that are spinning things to protect or massage or shape the truth. I think that at any given moment, Donald Trump completely and utterly believes that what he is saying is true. And I think that's kind of baffling us, because you can go back and look and see what he said. And like last night on the debate, it changed from day to day. And his answer was, well, I learned something new, and therefore I changed my answer. Mm-hmm. But at that moment in which he said everything, he believed it to be true. And so he believes he's speaking the truth at any given moment based on what he knows. There is no tentative quality to him. Therefore, there's nothing to protect. Therefore, there's nothing to spin against, because everything feels true to him. I think it speaks to the personality he has and the kind of audacity that he brings to the table that is different from other politicians. I think it's terrifying. I'll just say that right, because he does not have any doubt in him, which is not a good quality in a politician. But I think it's a different kind of spin, and I'm kind of curious what your guests make of that audacity.
Yeah, me too, Tim. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Chris, can I toss that first to you?
Sure. Well, I was just wondering, while that very good commentary was going on, whether Trump believed he was telling the truth when he said that he had a very bad earpiece, and that's why he wasn't condemning David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan, because they gave him a very bad earpiece. It wasn't even his fault that he had a bad earpiece. I agree, it's kind of terrifying. It's hard not to be amused by it as a satirist, though it's becoming slightly less amusing to me as time goes on. But it seems sociopathic almost to me at times.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure I would fully agree with the caller. I think Trump probably does at moments convince himself he's telling the truth. But, you know, I think when he raises the question of Ted Cruz's or Marco Rubio's citizenship, I think he knows that's all a lot of, well, the word I was going to use.
No, don't.
Probably, right. Well, I was going to say there's a good word of spin for it that the New York Times used to use, an 8-letter barnyard epithet. But the philosopher Harry Frankfurt talks about the BS word as not believing you're telling the truth, but not caring whether you're telling the truth or not. So it's different from lying. It's kind of a disregard. And I think that's kind of what Trump is doing a lot of the time. It's the 8-letter barnyard epithet.
We have a comment from Todd wondering if you two could talk about Stephen Colbert's word truthiness.
It's funny. I was just going to bring that up.
Oh, go ahead, Chris.
If he hadn't. Yeah, that's a brilliant concept, I think. Colbert said, basically, I feel it in my gut, so it's true. And certainly, I think that's what we're seeing from a lot of these candidates.
Yeah, and this is in Republic of Spin, my book as well. I have a section on the Bush presidency, which opens with a discussion of Colbert and truthiness. And I think both for George W. Bush personally, but also increasingly for the times we're living in, where people are kind of inhabiting ideological bubbles and reading and listening to media that reinforce their prior convictions, that truthiness is a resonant concept, because we all kind of want to grope for what feels true to us. And there's so much so many fragments of information flying around, it can be hard to sort of sort through in that sort of patient, rational way. Okay, this much is true and this much is false. So while George W. Bush kind of put that word on the map for Colbert, it's a wider phenomenon in our culture.
David, we almost have a little, almost a minute here before we have to take our break, but your book begins with Teddy Roosevelt. What can we learn from Teddy Roosevelt that might apply to what we're seeing today?
Well, I have a great deal more regard for Teddy Roosevelt than I do for Donald Trump, let me say to start. But there is an element of TR in Donald Trump, and not just the first two letters. Teddy Roosevelt was perhaps the first president, I would say probably the first president, to recognize that his own love of the limelight, his own theatrical personality, could be a valuable tool in getting stuff done. He tried to turn the presidency into a seat of political activism so that the president and not Congress would drive policy. To do that, he had to get public opinion on his side. And to get public opinion, he had to use the new mass media. He made speeches. He figured out how to make headlines. So, you know, one time he rode 98 miles on horseback to demonstrate that these army regulations that he was supporting were perfectly reasonable. If he, the president, could do it, so could an army grunt. So he understood public relations stunts. He understood, you know, how to get the media's attention and get them talking about the things you want them talking about. And a lot of that showmanship and theatricality that Teddy Roosevelt appreciated is certainly something Donald Trump appreciates as well.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with David Greenberg, author of Republic of Spin, an Inside History of the American Presidency, and with Christopher Cerf, co-author of Spinglish. And that has a subtitle as well. Here we go. The Definitive Dictionary of Deliberately Deceptive Language. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Christopher Cerf about Spinglish and David Greenberg about spin, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Chris, you write in the beginning of your book that English really lends itself to Spinglish because in many ways, there are just so many gosh darn words in our language.
Well, that's right. And they fall into two broad categories, which is why English is such a perfect language to be turned into Spinglish. Because, first of all, there are the Latin words, which are kind of flowery and sound, you know, more distinguished, less blunt, whereas Anglo-Saxon words are very blunt. So you can talk about killing somebody or you can talk about terminating them, you know, and there's a difference. Or a hospital recently talked about someone's failure to fulfill his wellness potential, which sounds a lot better than a medical accident, doesn't
it? Yes, it sure does. I mean, that's the problem with Spinglish, right? It's like language in a straitjacket or that has been come up with by a committee or someone working in the law department.
Well, often the latter. A lot of Spinglish, as we define it, comes from people trying to protect themselves against lawsuits. You'll see at the end of commercials, people will say, your results may vary in very small type. That means what we're saying probably won't work in your case.
And may I say, it's also comes out of the political consultants. You know, I have a section in here how in the 1990s, the pollster Frank Luntz worked with the Republicans to try to devise phrases that would put a better gloss or spin on their policies. And there are lots of famous examples of this, like the estate tax becoming the death tax, you know. And of course, the Democrats do this, too. One of the reasons I think support for gay marriage increases. It got recast as, you know, marriage equality,
exactly.
Instead of gay marriage, instead of doing something special for, you know, these other people. So, you know, both sides, of course, use that kind of political language.
Right. In fact, the Democrats tried to answer Luntz's death tax by calling it a wealth tax, and it didn't work. Luntz is better at it than most Democrats are. He's brilliant at it.
Let me just toss a quick question to you, David, then we'll get some more callers in on the conversation, a lot of comments as well. You talk about President Obama as the age of, quote, spin of no spin. So walk us through that. How does the president use spin and no spin?
Well, and this, in a way, it relates to what we were discussing before with Trump and to some degree Bernie Sanders. We are in an age where we're so saturated with spin, where voters, as I said before, are aware of it. They're clued into it. They're not. It's not just kind of penetrating into their brains without their knowledge. And so they look for politicians who are going to cut through the crap. And Obama in 2008 very much ran as a politician who was not going to be beholden to the consultants. And he writes about this in his second book about, you know, he wanted to maintain a political style that was free of that. And he talks about, he goes on Larry King Live in 2008 and says, we need more straight talk and less spin. The problem is, in 2010, after the Democrats took a shellacking, as he called it, in the midterm elections, he explains to the New York Times, you know, who asked, well, what was the problem here? He says, well, our policies were good, but we didn't come through in the marketing and the PR and the advertising. In effect, he had gone from saying we need less spin to saying we need more spin, which goes to my point that when spin is in the service of a cause we support, we actually tend to like it, or at least to tolerate it.
Let me see what Brian from Audubon has to say. Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. I just wanted to bring up the fact that, at least in the media, especially recently, we're seeing this big outrage about Donald Trump and it portraying him as very different from other Republican candidates and past Republican candidates, when in fact, especially on the issues, he seems to be saying the same things that other Republican candidates are saying, whether they move to the right because of him or otherwise. This doesn't seem to be a new thing within the Republican Party at all. And you can even see similarities between Donald and Barry Goldwater back in the 60s.
Well, Brian, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Do you want to take that, Chris? And then I'll toss that to you, David. I mean, whether it's style, substance, do you think Brian's on to something?
Well, I think there are certainly, I think one of the cleverest things he said that I agree with is that a lot of the Republican candidates feel they have to get to the right of him. And Cruz, of course, has been put in a position where he has to defend what a strong conservative he is. Trump actually is saying a lot of non-conservative things, but the right-wing things he says are startling, and that's why he gets so much attention. Building the wall, not allowing Muslims into the country at all, saying that he would go further than legal torture. That was one of the amazing things I heard last night, where he was asked, some of the things you're recommending are war crimes. How can you expect the CIA to do those things? And he said, I'll tell them to do it. You know, he's the tough guy. It goes very, very much with his remark about size earlier in the conversation.
And David, is it sort of the way people say things almost matters more than what they say?
Well, it's both. I mean, Trump has certainly deviated from what has been Republican Party orthodoxy for 25 years or more in profound ways on the Iraq War, on raising taxes on the rich, on trade, on kind words for Planned Parenthood. I mean, you go down the list. He really is not cut from the same cloth as most Republicans in this respect. But as Chris said, there are certain issues where he is way to the right, and that is getting him conservative support. But it's significant that he's doing best among independents, so that in the closed primaries where only Republicans can vote, he does less well. And interestingly, same thing on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton does better where it's confined to only Democrats and where independents can come in and monkey with the Democratic Party's choice. You have these outliers who, you know, Sanders is not a lifelong Democrat. Trump is not a lifelong Republican. And so you do see that deviation, and it's one thing that makes this year's race so interesting.
We have an email from JM, and this is about when President Obama, talking about the Affordable Care Act, said you can keep your doctor. There's certainly some questions about whether that has been true for everybody. And is that an example of spin, do you think, David?
Yeah, I think it is a good example. I mean, it started off, and I'm forgetting the exact language, when Obama first uttered that phrase, it was part of a longer construction that could be defended as technically true. And then in the telling, you know, certain words dropped out so that I think there were some times when he uttered it where you'd have to say, yeah, that wasn't true. That crossed the line. But that is sort of where spin versus lying is this kind of dangerous dance. And it can get into the realm of deception.
But often the deception isn't a lie at all. I mean, the Affordable Care Act is spin in a way. A lot of laws get named things. I think the Clean Air Initiative or something was actually, in the last administration, allowed, you know, burning forests down, things like that.
So, and we can't forget the Patriot Act, of course.
Well, that's a beautiful example. An acronym, of course. Yeah.
Let me just toss out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join our conversation with David Greenberg and with Christopher Cerf. Let me read a tweet from Ron. He says, a clear bit of Trump spin last night. Quote, I have too much respect for that process to say just release, and that's a reference to the New York Times transcripts. He apparently met with the editorial board, and a lot of that conversation was off the record, and journalists, you know, like to abide by that. But I guess the person giving the interview, in this case Trump, doesn't necessarily have to do that. But he said he has too much respect for the New York Times to do that. Chris?
Well, Cruz called him on that right away by saying, well, if he didn't say that, why doesn't he just release the tape? And it was interesting to hear Trump defend the press in that case. But, of course, he's the one who spoke off the record, so he could very easily put it on the record without betraying the New York Times. Of course, I do believe that people should be allowed to talk on deep background, as they call it. But in this case, he had the power to reveal what he said if he wanted to. David, or to say he didn't say it, too.
David, you teach this stuff. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I found in looking at the history of politicians throughout the century is, you know, I think it's probably fair to say some are more inclined to tell the truth than others, and some spin more aggressively than others. But even those who are most, beloved for their truth-telling, you know, go into moments where they have to spin or backpedal or flip-flop for political reasons. I mean, I think of John McCain in 2008 really became this media darling because he was a Republican who, you know, would call Jerry Falwell agents of intolerance. But then when he's running for president and is kind of sinking in the polls, he backpedals from all of that. And so the whole reputation for candor and straight talk, the spin of no spin, is sacrificed because he needs to get his party's nomination.
Well, I'm thinking about an interview that Hillary Clinton had recently where she was asked point blank, would you ever lie if you were president? And I mean, I'm not even sure how either a president or someone running for that high office answers that question. Chris, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think people have to do what you would call a white lie. Our book is making fun of deliberately deceptive things, not things that, which David's talking about, and I couldn't agree with more. There are political ways you have to say certain things, and other things you say to cover things up or misrepresent. And those are the things that amuse me in one sense and horrify me in another.
One story I tell in the book, in 1963, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, John F. Kennedy and his administration told some lies in order to protect the secret of Soviet missiles in Cuba until they were ready to go public with it. After the fact, a Pentagon flack named Arthur Sylvester said that the government has a, quote, right to lie when something like the future of the planet is at stake or when there are these major national security issues. This caused a huge outrage among the press. How dare he assert a right to lie? Now, I think Sylvester was probably correct, but you can't tell the truth that the government has a right to lie.
That's right.
Well, you have to come up with a different word or euphemism for it, I guess.
Exactly, a different spin.
Right. There's, of course, a way to tell the truth and also make it a lie in reality. The term WMD, weapons of mass destruction, is a brilliant one because theoretically nuclear weapons and an old canister of mustard gas are both WMD. So if they had found one canister of mustard gas, Bush would have been right. They probably did find one eventually, but it didn't turn the argument around. But that was a brilliant there was a think tank actually called the Project for a New American Century.
That's right.
That Bill Kristol and others made up a lot of these words. Regime change was another word that they popularized, and that's another brilliant one too, because you can talk about regime change without ever mentioning that you're going to occupy a country or invade it. And of course, normally you do that in a way that was preemptive, which means, of course, that you struck first.
Let me read a tweet from Jay. I think this is directed to you, David. Jay says, the term marriage equality is not spin. It's what it is. Spin is calling it something it's not. He's saying marriage equality is not spin. It's what it actually is. Marriage equality.
Well, look, I'm using the term spin to refer to the artful construction of language and image for political purposes. Spin doesn't, in my view, doesn't mean that it's false. And I do think that, yes, you can say there's equality between what heterosexuals and homosexuals have in this case. But let's think of that formulation where at the last convention, the Democrats should say it shouldn't be dependent on the color of your skin or who you love. I mean, that to a lot of Americans is a much more appealing way of thinking about equality for gays and lesbians than are other formulations that had been historically used. So there is an artful construction of language here. I'm not saying it's bad or Democrats or mm-hmm. liberals were wrong to use this phrase, but there is an element of spin involved.
Of course, and it doesn't mean lying. It can mean lying, but deceptive is different from lying. The perfect example that everybody knows is pro-choice versus pro-life. Those terms are both correct, and they talk about the same thing. But nobody wants to say they're against life, you know. So it's a brilliant term
because it has the word pro in it, right?
Yes, and who would be against your right to choose?
Right. So newspapers, I think the New York Times, for example, uses abortion rights and anti-abortion, trying to avoid the pro-life, pro-choice spin. But those terms have so invaded our vocabulary, we use them almost unthinkingly. Mm.
And that's the language you're supposed to use on public radio as well. We're almost out of time here. Christopher Cerf, do you have another book in the offing sort of on this theme of language?
Well, I think we're still finding so much spin in every day's newspaper that we want to keep working on this for a while and probably update it, but I'm not sure what the next one will be.
But it sounds
I'll find out too.
But it sounds as if this political campaign is going to give you a fair amount of fodder.
You bet, and of course business too. I want to mention the head of Yahoo the other day talked about remixing her company, which meant she laid off 1,100 people. She was remixing the labor force. That's great spin. Or giving someone a career change opportunity, somebody recently said. So it's not just politics.
Indeed it is not. Christopher Cerf, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. It was fun.
Fun for us as well. Co-author of this book called Spinglish with his collaborator Henry Beard. Again, contributor to the National Lampoon. He's also a composer and a lyricist. David Greenberg, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Historian of American politics, professor of history and of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. And his book is called Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.